and welcome to East Meets West. I'm Olga Bataman.
I'm Tara Reid. Yes, so the news lately is that a warmonger is now gone. Lindsey Graham died.
Right. And he died less than 24 hours after meeting Zelensky in Kyiv.
Which has led to all kinds of speculations.
Right.
Laura Loomer, who, remember, threatened to sue me a couple months ago, she's claiming it was Vladimir Putin.
She said that it was either Russia or Iran who poisoned him specifically. That was her suggestion. But you know what? When I read it in the news, I mean, he was 71, and a heart attack could happen to a man of 71 years old, right?
Especially after a long flight, after a trip.
That sounded quite a natural cause, I would say. But when people like Laura Loomer started speculating with this, you know, that he was poisoned by Russia and Iran, and then there was another blogger who claimed that he could have been bombed, you know.
At a drone
factory,
yes,
in Ukraine. That's when, for me, it started smelling really bad, you know? Because when you have this blame game, it means that it could have not been this sudden disease, as they put it. So maybe there was really something different behind his death.
Well, and you're right to speculate in that sense, because it is a couple of days before they're passing the Save America Act that he was really trying to push. He was also trying to push some more sanctions against Russia. He was also trying to push bombing towards Iran, which happened yesterday. Lindsey Graham, in my opinion, and many of the viewers who have followed me throughout the years, I've had a lot of shows talking about what a warmonger Lindsey Graham is, how much damage he's done, how much he did not care about humanity or children, like Gaza.
He was the one who was pushing to drop a nuclear bomb on Gaza.
Right.
He was the one who said that the money spent on Ukraine is the money best spent because of Russians dying. And he was the one who was initiating, as it was called, sanctions from the hell. So, right. I mean, we in Russia usually prefer not to say negative things about people who just passed away, but it seems that he knew where he would end up.
Look how much harm he's done to Americans, to people in the world, the visceral, you know, hatred he had towards Russia. And by the way, I wanted just to ask you, can you imagine a Russian official in his position, like at the State Duma, and for the audience members, State Duma is like the U.S. Congress, saying something about Americans like that? That's just never happened.
I definitely cannot. It never happened.
No. And the other thing he said, one of the last quotes he said was, he said to a presenter who was asking him about America First, he said, "I'm not with you, I'm with Israel until my dying day."
And Minister Ben-Gvir, when Lindsey Graham passed away, he called him the beloved friend of Israel, which also I think speaks for itself, right?
Yeah.
But by the way, Alexander Dugin on X, replying to those, you know,
Laura Loomer's claims
about Lindsey Graham being killed or poisoned by Russia and Iran, he suggested that that could be a black mark for Trump, and he suggested that Mossad could have something to do with that. But let's discuss it with the guest who is already with us today, Richard Sakwa, professor at the University of Kent. Richard, so good to have you on our show to discuss this news.
Yeah, wonderful to have you, Richard.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, actually. It's lovely to see you.
So what do you think of all that and all of the speculations of what caused Lindsey Graham's death?
The BBC reported it in a rather factual manner. He said after a short illness, he died. The illness was exceptionally short because just the day before, as you've pointed out, he was, for example, on the Danny Davis show or clip of that speech you've just mentioned, in which he came back from Ukraine, came back from Kyiv, threatening all those more sanctions, more pressure and so on. So quite clearly, I have no idea. I mean, I assume it was what the version is that, you know, 71, he was only 71 years young. So it was indeed quite surprising that he should have died in this way. We don't know on the physiological side of things, but politically, it means that, yes, as you say, he was virulently Russophobic. He was in the tradition of John McCain, another one, who, of course, McCain, who said Russia was a gas station with nukes, a dreadful comment. It's, you know, classic, you know, as Edward Said would say, Orientalist, completely dismissive of a great civilization, a great culture. It's the sort of thing people sometimes say about China or some other country, and you'd have expected it in the sort of the height of the new imperialism in the late 19th century. To hear this in the second quarter of the 21st century really is a throwback. It shows how little humanity, certainly the US political elite, have developed. And of course, it's got worse. We have Trump calling the Iranian leadership scum. And the use of such language is a degradation, the coarsening of language in general and political language and the discourse between nations in particular. But as you say, you note that both the Russian and the Chinese, and indeed the Indian and most other country leadership, they maintain normal courtesies, normal standards, normal civil discourse. It's the United States in particular, but also, I'm afraid, our European leaders, whose language has coarsened, become simplistic, cannot entertain the idea of dialogue, let alone diplomacy. And Lindsay, of course, was the worst of the lot. And just one final point. Of course, he was the one who, earlier in his career, had completely condemned, excoriated Trump himself. And then, of course, by the end, once he became the worst of the Trump whisperers, playing golf with him. And, of course, shifting Trump, and this has huge policy implications, it was Lindsey Graham who shifted Donald J. Trump's attempts to mediate, to present himself as a negotiator, ending the war. And it was Lindsey Graham who constantly opposed that, quite apart from European leaders. He had major influence. So whether this will lead to a softening or reopening of US diplomatic channels to Moscow, we wait to see. But it does provide an opportunity, possibly, for that.
Richard, that's what I was going to ask you, because definitely Lindsey Graham was kind of a spokesperson of the U.S. war machine, mm-hmm. I have to say. But he was not the only one, because this war machine was deeply, mm-hmm. so to say, installed in the U.S. System. So do you think without Lindsey Graham, the machine would still be there in place, right? So what would come next? What would you say?
Yeah, that's right. The machine remains, and if you like, the military-industrial complex. You remember that communist Eisenhower in his farewell speech. And of course, Ray McGovern talks about MICIMAT, the military-industrial, whatever, media, think tank, media, all of that, that vast machine which is now working for militaristic purposes, it remains in place. But the only slight mitigation, so you're absolutely right, is the fact that Trump really is influenced by a number of individuals. His policy is highly individualized. So while the machine is always there, the machine is always pushing for more war, and Lindsey Graham was their spokesman. He never saw a war that he didn't like. And indeed, as Tyra says, not only didn't he like it, but he actually approved of it, and he gloried in the death and the destruction and the exercise of unrestrained U.S. military power. So I do think it could. His passing, his death, does suggest that one of the influences on Trump will be has been removed. One of the malign influences, let's put it this way.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you brought up his being almost gleeful, and that's how he would come across, almost a weird light in his eye, like the way people talk about love or sex or whatever, when he would talk about killing and murdering. It was really just disheartening to Americans and off-putting. He was not very popular in America, so it's amazing he was able to stay in Senate. But now you have two senators that were going to be gone, because you have Graham, but you also have Mitch McConnell, who they say now is brain dead. So you have two of these Trump allies that are gone. And Israel's still got his hands on that legislation where they want to merge the IDF with the American military. You know, how does that translate over to the UK, and what are your thoughts on that, and Europe, and the Europe's view on that?
First of all, just to say that this NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, which, as you say, was effectively merging US and Israeli policy, unprecedented, and it's astonishing. And as for European policy on this issue, it's nowhere. I mean, when it comes to the Middle East, there's, you know, we're now in, for this particular, I'm talking about Palestine, since October 2023. So we're now coming up to the third year, and the European Union, and of course, the escalation of violence on the West Bank, quite apart from the extension of the war to Lebanon, and the European Union, and of course, the British government, UK, EU, has isn't even at first base, I think is a US term, in responding to it. Yes, the European Union still supports Palestinian causes, I mean, humanitarian ones, that is, but that's minimal. And in the third year of war, where we've got the International Court of Justice, we've got ICC and so on, talking about genocide, and yet no response, while any slight event on the Eastern Front, if one can call it that, evokes a massive response. So the US is going in, you know, this NDAA, and of course, we're now seeing after the Ankara NATO summit, the militarization of the European Union, endless talk of NATO 3.0, which is basically returning to where it began, NATO 1.0, which was, of course, anti-Soviet and a militaristic defense organization. It's going back to that stance after Ankara, but a bit more complicated than that, of course, because time has moved on. The world has moved on. The simple binary of capitalism versus communism is gone. So, so we're seeing basically bloc discipline developing on the Western side. Meanwhile, of course, as you say, your program called East Meets West. Don't say that too quickly when you've had a
drink
or two, by the way. I've just suddenly realized how that's not so easy to say, but. But the question is, where is the East in all of this? Where's the East? It's, you know, we're endless talk of China. China's, set forward 2 or 3 years ago a set of peace proposals. They weren't peace proposals, they were a framework for peace, and they were good ones. On the development of BRICS, for example, Iran is a member of BRICS. And what is BRICS doing? And of course, two BRICS members basically fighting each other. So the East itself needs to work to develop a greater political profile, which may then counter some of this warmongering and militarism of the political West.
Well, they're trying to, but I was actually going to ask you about the NATO summit that you just mentioned. And first of all, in the final declaration, which was really short, I think it was the shortest declaration throughout the last years. It only had like 6 points, and one of them was just gratitude to Turkey that hosted it. But in this declaration, NATO countries stated that Russia posed the biggest threat to NATO countries, and what shocked me, the biggest long-term threat. So what does it mean as for you, Professor Sakwa? Because as for me, long-term threat means something that does not depend on who is the president. It does not depend on what's going on the battlefield, or it does not depend on the policy, for example, towards Ukraine. Right. It means that you're an enemy just for the very fact of your existence, does it?
That's a fascinating, you've pointed out, this is the second point of a 6-point declaration at the end. As you say, it's the shortest in their history. They had to come up with something. And so that's one reason why, of course, they're probably planning not to have a summit next year and to go back to what they did before, which was a summit every 2 years. But you're right, long-term can be interpreted the way you've just done, that Russia is a long-term existential enemy, irrespective of the leader and so on. But you could see it another way. And the other way of seeing it is to say that it isn't an immediate threat. So it could be a more positive spin to say it's a long term, which means if it's long term, we don't need to spend money now. That you know, it's there, sitting there in its eastern corner. But you know, we don't need to do what the Europeans or the Poles and the Estonians saying they're going to invade the day after tomorrow. So we have to bump up defence spending and send the missiles in and so on and so forth. So that is a second way of looking at it. That you, in other words, they were kicking the Russian threat into the long grass.
By the way, what do you think of this technology transfer, I mean Patriot technology transfer to Ukraine that was also announced at this NATO summit? Because as for me, but maybe I'm wrong, maybe in my perception is different from yours, but for me, it sounds as Trump is trading air, as we say now, because, you know, one thing is just giving Patriots now. And the other thing is that, okay, one, at some point of time, a couple of years later, the factory will be built, the plant will be built, so you have to manufacture it yourself. What do you think of this Patriot technology transfer to Ukraine announced at the NATO summit?
I agree with you. That, in other words, it's like me saying to you, I've got an excellent bridge I could sell you, which means I'm never going to deliver it. It's just nonsense.
You can build
trading
it.
Trading air, I like that.
Yeah,
phrase.
Just build it yourself, you know, that's what they did.
Yeah. The point is they can't. Even if they, first of all, there's a lot of patented technology involved in a Patriot missile, which just simply means that the intellectual property to give it to the Ukrainians, who are, of course, one of the most corrupt countries in the world, is going to be, it'll be in Pakistan or whatever, 2 days, or Nigeria,
yeah,
2 days later,
exactly. Right.
First. And second, if they started building it in Ukraine, then the Russians would bomb it within, you know, as soon as, before even the factory is built to do it. Third, there is stuff within the Patriot missile, there's welding and high-tech elements on the engineering precision. If you are 1 millimeter out, these Patriots can explode on site. It's super melding of metals and so on. I'm not an engineer, but if you get the idea, that in other words, it's really high specifications. And to get to those specifications, it isn't just the IP in general. On a specific welding and other techniques, if they were to give it away, then, you know, the Russians could get hold of it, somebody else, anybody, Chinese, Indians. So it is, as you say, a lovely parcel of fresh air, which, by the way, I've got good stocks of, and I can sell it to you. At bargain prices, I can sell it to you really cheap. Yeah. Special offer for you guys.
You know, I admire so many, you've authored so many books, and I'd like to share with our audience some of the names, some of the titles of the books, if you don't mind sharing them. But one of your most recent one was really focusing on Russophobia, and I'm so glad Olga's here to address this too about Russophobia, because from the American part, a lot of the Russophobia ramped up as a political means for the Clinton-Biden administration. Biden was friends, as you know, with John Kerry and with McCain, and they all were very much hawkish towards Russia. In fact, when I worked in the 90s, I was at a meeting where they said Russia would never have a seat at the table. This is when the Soviet Union had fallen and there was a transition happening. And then Vladimir Putin happened, and he has brought Russia to the power and the vibrant state that it is today through his leadership and the people around him that have led the Russian people in a very positive way. You have, and I live here, so it's my perspective. This isn't just propaganda. You have healthcare, education. You have a healthy working class here. You have young people that are able to buy a home or an apartment, a flat. They're able to start a business. So you have a very thriving economy. It's not just that Russia's a world power or has nuclear weapons. They are a thriving population of happy Christian, mostly Orthodox Christian, Muslim, all different kinds of nationalities and ethnic groups with a 1,000-year cultural history that's doing well. Now, this doesn't sit well with the West, right? So you understand why they amped up the Russophobia to feed that military complex. But from the European perspective, can you give, based on your writings, why it's gone back so far, centuries, and what's happening now?
Yeah, two things. The first one, yes, Russia is amazing. In the fifth year of the war, it's still remaining, a high degree of normality, a high degree of mm-hmm. achievement, and in fact, development. Building motorways, the Moscow metro system seems to be growing exponentially, almost as far as Shanghai's and so on. It's amazing. There are difficulties, so we shouldn't hide them, that in the fifth year of war, there's economic, the budget deficit, the technological strain. The list is quite long. So we shouldn't no one should about anything become, mm-hmm. Not suggesting you are, of course, complacent, because really there are fundamental challenges, and this, military Keynesianism has only got a certain amount of mileage in it, because it's deflecting investment from more productive investment and long-term social and infrastructural development. First. Second, talking about the European side, yes, one of the fundamental arguments, I think, would be to say clearly, Western Europe is in the economic, political, and social doldrums. There's no question about it. We can see it in economic growth rate, which are sluggish to negative. We can see it in the unpopularity of governments across, Germany, France, UK, perhaps slightly exceptional in Italy and some other places. But above all, as the Draghi report, Mario Draghi report, put it 2 years ago, productivity, competitiveness is very low. Europe is in danger of being marginalized in all respects. It's got whatever you say about it in the United States, the United States has a remarkable power to reinvent itself. And it's got that sort of dynamism and vitality, which, we admire. And there's, many admirable things about the United States, and that's one of them. There's many negative things, but give what's due. Whereas Europe's lacking it, completely lacking it at the moment. It really doesn't have a model of development. And the belief that, yes, that it is projecting its own failures onto Russia, and that is one of the causes of contemporary Russophobia. Because you mentioned Russophobia, it's an article which I hope to publish soon. And it's one of the factors is that Russophobia isn't something just normal criticism of Russia, which is valid, of course. All countries should be criticized. It keeps them on their toes, and that's what they need. But Russophobia goes deeper. It's not just a critique of Russia, it's a visceral hatred. So in other words, as I say elsewhere and argue in a paper, it isn't, even the word phobia is not good enough, because if you have a phobia about spiders, you keep out of their way, arachnophobia. You don't go out of your way to kill spiders. You live and let live and say, keep them. Whereas it's like misanthropy or hatred of something. And so misorussis is a better term, perhaps, a hatred. And it's so profound and it's so enduring, despite even despite the different changes of regimes from capitalist democracy today, state capitalist system today, to the Soviet system of state socialism and the Russian Empire. And there's a lot of factors which feed into it. But the phenomenon itself, we need to understand. And contemporary Russophobia merges, melds, and is amplified because of Cold War traditions as well. So the geopolitical and the geocultural combine, that in some way Russia is always presented as the outsider, the other. And as you hinted, in part, it is because it has defended its own sovereignty. And it wanted to join the political West, but as an autonomous, sovereign, independent power. And that obviously was unacceptable in Washington, less acceptable even in Brussels, who wanted to see the normative transformation of Russia. Some of it was good. We'd all like to see, everywhere, the strong rule of law, strong defense of constitutional norms. That's good. But when it is used as a weapon to undermine sovereignty and autonomy and development, and indeed then insisting on a particular model of capitalism, which in the 1990s led to all those social disasters, which have now in large part been overcome, then that's something else. So Russophobia merges with the Cold War, each amplifies the other, and so we end up where we are today, which is the attempt to cancel or negate Russia, unprecedented in world history. When else, in even in wartime, did they cut? Obviously, with Nazi Germany, but that's very different. When do you cut off transport links? No direct flights, cultural, educational exchanges, when they can't even put on a Russian opera or so on and so forth, in which you can now a little bit. And a total sporting ban as well. I mean, this is something, we're dealing with a phenomenon, and it's very hard for us to get our heads around it. It's certainly hard for me to understand the depth of it. Because, one final point, yeah, as you say, I spent time recently in Russia, you know, at the Imamoz Primakov sketch, Tenya,
we met.
Yes, indeed, at Imamoz Institute for International Economics and International Politics. Really excellent session. Many different views, very pluralistic. By the way, it was very open debate there, and it was really a very impressive section, just like the Valdai meetings, where you have different viewpoints as well. But one thing which came out of it was the fact that this hatred is so irrational, because ultimately, just look at you guys. I mean, Russia is a European country. Not necessarily a Western country. It's a European country, all the way from Smolensk to Vladivostok. It shares a culture, as you say, Orthodox Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, whatever. But it has now become an extraordinarily tolerant, inclusive, European developmental state. And Europe stuck in economic doldrums, political sterility, intellectual bankruptcy. They hate to see that. What's this Russia, this upstart country, what's it doing? I mean, we need to biff it, bash it to make sure it doesn't. And then, of course, just one final point that, even today, on the talking about Lindsey Graham, they were saying that Russia's, and the European Union said that, Ursula von der Leyen, Russian expansionism need to be stopped. Expansionism. As if the war was over security, it was over other, clearly. But just this, a certain number of little ideologems, I think, memes, repeated, unprovoked. Expansionism and all of that. It's a substitute for thinking, substitute for debate, substitute for intellectual, strategic planning and thinking about issues.
Richard, you mentioned this Russophobia, and I guess they're spreading it all over the news, like everywhere, is that Russia is preparing for a war and Europe should prepare for the war either by the year of 2028 or by the year 2030. And they are pushing towards the increase of military spendings. And you already stated the state of economy Europe is now, right, which is declining. So do you think the increase in military spending would actually improve the well-being of Europeans? Why are they pushing so much, this idea of Russia preparing for a war?
We are, unfortunately, locked in an arms race, worse than anything, or as bad, certainly, in the height of the Cold War. It is an arms race. And to be honest, Russia should prepare for a war. Any country should, because it has to prepare for any eventuality. However, you need to have that accompanied by strategic thinking. Really, what are our national interests? What is our strategic future? And I'm afraid that Russia's arms race now is clearly in response to this war fever in Western Europe, less than the United States, by the way, apart from Lindsey Graham and earlier John McCain and that sort of wing. The MAGA, the Trumpian base, is not warmongering. They wanted restraint. They wanted focus on US domestic issues. There's plenty enough of those. What about those bridges collapsing and degeneration and so on? That was the Trumpian promise when he was elected. It was people like Lindsey Graham, which pushed him into this militaristic, and Netanyahu and all the others. As for Europe, you're absolutely right. It's war fever. And it's a war fever like the sort that you would have at various moments before the First World War and so on. And of course, even though, as you indicate, Europe is in no position to fight a war, it doesn't have, without the United States, it lacks fundamental elements, radar, satellite observation, intelligence, et cetera, the list is very long. And it doesn't have the money. Military Keynesianism for everyone is always a short-term response, yes, to a threat, you need it sometimes. That's in 1939, 40, 41 in England before the war, but or the United States. But it does detract. And of course, we don't. All these countries have huge budgetary challenges. We know it in the United Kingdom. We have basically we have to have budget cuts. We don't know where it's going to happen. We had our defense investment plan announced a few weeks ago in the United Kingdom. Even that plan, which was very modest compared to what they wanted, the militarists wanted, and it's still, even that plan which was announced isn't funded. It's still a £5 billion shortfall, 4.7 billion. Mm. Where will this money come from? Are you going to cut schools, health services, and so on? All of those have been cut endlessly since austerity policies of the Conservative Lib Dem government since 2010. What more can you cut? When you see the physical infrastructure decaying, when you can see the waiting lists for the National Health Service, they're slightly decreasing now, but they're far, far too long. And the list is just endless. So it's a distraction. It shows the low quality of the political elites in the West today, throughout the West. Mm-hmm. There's occasionally people, a spark of intelligence. Giorgio Meloni, by the way, is a very, very adroit political leader, one has to say, in Italy. You may not like her policies, but she's certainly adroit and, you know, an intelligent leader. Unfortunately, she is the exception rather than the rule.
But what's happening in the United Kingdom now? Because we saw, for example, just the other day, RT producer James Scott, he was interrogated with all of his gadgets confiscated when he landed in the United Kingdom. And he's not a public person. He's not an anchor. He's not a correspondent. He's just a producer. So he never appeared on camera, you know, and he was just visiting Manchester where his family lives. He's a UK citizen. And just before that, we had Daniel Kowalik on our show, who is an American citizen, and he was flying to the United Kingdom. And he was also stopped, interrogated, and his devices confiscated. So, this stitch, I would say, which canvas, bigger canvas, is this stitch a part of? Is it also this Russophobia? Are they, harassing everyone who has something to do with RT or who speaks against, the war in Iran? So what big canvas is this stitch a part of?
The big canvas is the fact that this has been going on for some time. Those detentions are usually held under Section 3 of the 2019 Counterterrorism Act.
Right.
Then there were another. We've had a whole succession of them. Another one in 2022. But this Section 3 of the 2019 Act is particularly malevolent. You're allowed to be detained for 6 hours without being arrested. So what's the difference between detention and arrest? I'm not entirely sure. 6 hours. You're not allowed not to answer questions. So if you refuse to say, if you say no comment, that will be taken as an indication of guilt, and then you will be arrested. So it's a complete catch-22. More than that, they have the right to take your mobile phone, your laptop, and they then impound it and download the entire contents. And obviously, they then use an artificial intelligence to comb through it to get anything. It's draconian, and it's undermining the very civil liberties. So it goes against all the way back to 1215 Magna Carta, to be honest, and habeas corpus, that clearly it is completely outrageous. George Galloway has suffered from it, other ones. I've been detained under itself. And so it's quite outrageous. And the larger element is to say that, in particular, for example, the Starmer government for the last 2 years really intensified it. So what is worst, in my view, of all of this? You expect this sort of behaviour. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but you expect this sort of behaviour from the right wing, from the Conservative government, especially of the sort of Conservative governments we had recently, apart from Rishi Sunak, who was involved with technology, and he was more of a genuine technocrat rather than the ideologues of the Boris Johnson sort and Liz Truss. Whereas Starmer, what is most disturbing is that he comes out from the social democratic tradition, from the labor movement, and yet Starmer, one of his first things, we were on a call with Jeremy Corbyn once for calling for peace. It was a peace movement, you know, Stop the War coalition. And even as we were talking, Starmer, in response to what we were saying, he actually said, to be opposed to NATO is incompatible with Labour Party membership. The Labour Party has always had a large peace movement in it. It's always had a... This is the intellectual bankruptcy of which I speak. No vision of the future, a endless emphasis on militarism. And if it wasn't Russia, it would be China or somebody else. It really needs it. Obviously, Russia is an ideal enemy because ideal in an ironic sense, of course, because the long history and so on. But it shows basically the dead end where Western politics is, where even social democracy has got nothing to offer, and it's repudiated its own traditions. And of course, Starmer then went on to expel all those within the Labour Party who were fighting for peace, who talked about Palestine. I met many of them at these various meetings where we would call for peace and dialogue. And you keep coming across these people. I'm in Canterbury at the moment, and we have a town called Whitstable just on the coast here. And the famous case of Betty. 65 years, she was quite aged now, not in the first flush of youth, at 65 years in the Labour Party, expelled for calling for peace and negotiations with Ukraine.
It's crazy.
But now Starmer is...
Tens of thousands. Yeah.
But now Starmer is out, and most probably Andy Burnham would be next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. May we ask you to comment on him? Because does it seem any better?
I've said it since 2010 that it couldn't get worse. And each Prime Minister... Now, this will be Andy Burnham... Andy Burnham unless anything major happens, Andy Burnham will become leader of the Labour Party this coming Friday. So that's in 5 days' time from we meeting here on the 13th of July. And then he will become Prime Minister in exactly 1 week on Monday next week. So the 20th of July, he becomes leader. So we do need to... a lot of people are asking me. Most people are sceptical. I keep saying that it can't get worse. So from Cameron to May to Johnson to Liz Truss, this will be our seventh Prime Minister in 10 years.
Wow.
Can it get worse? It's almost unimaginable. No, it won't. Burnham did a very interesting thing on the 10th of July, last Friday. He made this announcement condemning the way the Labour Party, the Labour government, responded to the initial mass murders and massacres and genocide in Gaza. And he apologised for its reaction. He didn't need to do it. That took political courage. You would never expect that from Starmer, who, precisely as the war began, he said the Israelis have the right to cut off water, electricity to the men, women and children. Unbelievable, unbelievable. He then said he was misquoted. He was not. And so... I do believe, I think there's no room for optimism in this case, but there is a sense that Burnham has a chance, and already the courage in making that statement suggests he will be cut from a different stamp than Starmer, who was, you know, just utterly morally bankrupt.
But he stands for more support, you know, and military aid to Ukraine still, from what I know.
To Ukraine, yes, he does. He couldn't get away. In the United Kingdom, the atmosphere is so virulently Russophobic that any attempt, I keep saying it, Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform, just before the July 2024 election, did say, look, Russia, we have to understand why Russia invaded. And for that, he has been excoriated, attacked viciously, and he's never mentioned it again. He used to work for RT, do program, and that's being held against him. So Burnham is constrained politically by what we said earlier, the military, the warmongering, the deep state, as they'd call it in the United States, the militaristic state. Yeah. So he is constrained. And in the United Kingdom, we've got a very powerful security establishment. of which we've just talked about some of the victims of that security establishment. And so he has to be very careful. And he is not breaking the consensus on the Russo-Ukrainian war. So mm-hmm. he's maintaining that we have to continue. But whether he will devote, like Starmer, Keir Starmer was known as Never Hear Care. Today, even, he's in Paris at a meeting of the Coalition of the Willing. So he's never here. He never dealt with domestic problems. Burnham will focus on domestic issues. And obviously, by inertia, perhaps he will continue the war. But he won't be spending all his time not just provoking a war, but like Starmer did, preventing a negotiation. Remember how they ran off to Washington after Anchorage, after the Alaska meeting, to, remember the seven, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I don't want to say that Trump is a Snow White, but the seven dwarfs surrounding the desk in the White House, in the Oval Office, mm-hmm. calling for him to repudiate the opening, which was possible at the Alaska meeting in August 2025. I don't think Burnham will do that.
Well, you say that, but I was thinking about Alaska, but let's go back to Boris when he interfered in Turkey in Istanbul, famously.
The negotiations.
Yeah. So do you see Burnham doing something like that as we're moving closer to peace?
No, never. I mean, he would go to call for peace rather than to. It was Boris Johnson went on the 9th of April 2022 mm-hmm. Everybody participating in it, including the Ukrainian side, say we were 95% towards getting a deal. And it would then have meant that the special military operation really was a type of coercive diplomacy to push the West, to push Ukraine to the negotiating table. And a deal was on the table. He went there. Of course, even Zelensky, after Bucha and so on, was saying we've got to get a deal. Boris Johnson tilted the balance to say war. You don't talk to Russians, you bash them on the nose, was basically his argument. We'll give you the money if you're willing to die. It was so, Boris Johnson, why? Of course, at this Istanbul meeting, you had two clowns, two comedians talking to each other, Zelensky and Johnson.
Right.
How on earth, you could have, I say this for Zelensky, probably one of the worst leaders the world has ever seen, willing to sacrifice his own nation. This war is two great nations, the Ukrainian and the Russian, two Slavic, mainly dominant countries, two Orthodox countries, basically beating the hell out of each other, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, dying. It's just insane, absolutely insane. We have to get to peace so that both countries can live in dignity, sovereignty, and to follow their own paths to the future.
I wouldn't say there are two big nations. There is one nation, or at least like two twins that someone managed to drive apart. So, I wouldn't call it two big nations.
That's half the problem, what Olga's saying. That the problem is that they're so close together, they're so close in all the way, which means that Ukrainians want to distance themselves, and that's actually half the problem, is the fact that there is this constituency within Ukraine who are frightened precisely of this closeness. But even today, even as they're in the trenches fighting, not anymore now with drones, but the Ukrainians and the Russians are watching the same films. Often they're shouting to each other in the same language. It makes this war even worse. Even worse.
But they put a lot of effort, the Westerners, in driving apart these two twins. They put a lot of fuel, a lot of effort.
Yeah, and the coup in 2014, it was orchestrated by the U.S. and NATO. And NATO has never been a peacekeeping force. It never will be. It's used.
Was OEC, yeah. By the way.
Yeah, and now that UK was like the chattel of the US, and now UK has kind of gone rogue and doing their own kind of aggression with Germany and France. So it's interesting to see how it'll play out.
But hopefully, without the spokesperson of the war machine that we discussed, at least for a while, there is more chance, for reaching a peaceful solution, right?
Right, yeah. And could you tell our viewers a little more about how to find your work, Richard? You have so many good books and so many good papers. How can they find you if they want to learn more about your work and read some of your papers and whatnot?
It's an excellent question and a good question, but it always puts me on the back foot because I've got no social media presence. I've even got a Substack, which I've never written on Substack, but I've got nearly 100 followers. And I've never posted anything. I must do, just out of loyalty to them, for a start. And I'm planning to do so. But I suppose, and I shouldn't say this, but if you go on Amazon, you can see a list of the books available. But I know it's not always available across many different jurisdictions. Let's put it this way. So, but it's a bit hard. The University of Kent website has a list of the most publications.
Yeah, so for our viewers, just as for now, follow Richard Sakwa on East Meets West. Richard, thank you so much for being with us and for this discussion that we had today. We managed to cover such a broad spectrum of topics. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, it was wonderful to see you again and hopefully see you at future Valdai discussion groups as well.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for our viewers, please stay in touch with us. Send your us your guest suggestions and the questions that maybe you want to ask but don't dare. We'll do it for you here on East Meets West.
Yeah, and thank you for all your feedback. And we'll continue to answer your questions. And I posted a recent thing, movetorussia.com, and also about the Bridge Club. For those of you that have been DMing me about moving to Russia or coming for travel, touristing, and maybe sometime you can come get a tour of the set and even meet Olga and me. Take care.
Take care.